morning. Students from Rufus King High School, would they stand, please? Thank you. We're delighted you're here. You may be seated. The students are with us with a program run by the State Bar and the Supreme Court called Court with Class. And we invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. The students have received materials about the case we are about to hear. And the students will meet with a justice at noon to talk about the court procedures, and anyone who wishes to join that session at noon is welcome to do so. And the noon presentation today will be by Justice Crooks. We've met you. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, with whom you'll meet. The empty chair on my immediate left is usually occupied by Justice John Wilcox, but he has had surgery and is recovering well, but will not participate in the following case. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right is Justice David Crooks. With these introductions made, we will proceed to our second case for the day, 01-2227D, Lawyer Regulation System versus, and is it Duke Cayman? Duchman. Would counsel please take their seats at the table? And we have Paul W. Schwarzenbart representing the Lawyer Regulation System. You have 25 minutes, counsel. Mr. Hart, representing the respondent, has 30 minutes, and you, Mr. Schwarzenbart, have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Schwarzenbart.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Paul Schwarzenbart. I appear today as counsel for the Lawyer Regulation System of the State of Wisconsin. The matter before the court today involves the question of self-regulation of the state bar. The complainant in this action is Ronald Smith, who served as an appointee of this court and member of the special investigative panel established under Supreme Court Rule 22.25 sub 1. Mr. Smith, as a panel member, was assigned to investigate a disciplinary complaint or a grievance filed against the respondent, attorney James Duchemin. The grievant was a prospective divorce client of Mr. Duchemin named Jennifer Meyer. This, Your Honors, may be the first example of a case of this type proceeding under the newly revised procedures under Chapters 20 through 22 of the Supreme Court rules, the way in which the process here operated, because Mr. Duchemin had served as a member of one of the local district committees, was that the matter went outside the Office of Lawyer Regulation for investigation through the special panel. Mr. Smith investigated, there was cause to proceed, found. Mr. Smith had a number of options open to him under the newly revised disciplinary code, Supreme Court Rule 22.08 sub 2. Ultimately, with a finding of cause to proceed and without the consent of the respondent, the only option open to Mr. Smith was to proceed with filing a disciplinary complaint in this matter. As a preliminary comment, Your Honors, I would like to note that while the complainant in this action seeks only a private reprimand of the respondent, this should not be construed to suggest either that this case is not an important case or that the principles at stake are not important. I think the issues in this case go to the reasonable expectations of clients who reasonably expect to be able to confer privately with their lawyers, and that the lawyer will not be discussing the client's business outside the office without the express authorization of the client or unless the discussions outside the office are necessary as part of rendering professional services. That's the implied consent exception. We believe that those expectations are embodied in Supreme Court Rule 20:1.6A, that those expectations are consistent with the lawyer's role as an agent and fiduciary of the client. The client should not have to instruct the lawyer that they shouldn't be talking about the client's business outside the office. What the complainant submits that the record shows in this case is that, in fact, Mr. Duschenman did discuss the prospective client's business outside the office without her consent, either expressed or implied. And for that reason, the complainant's position is that the undisputed facts of record establish a violation of the disciplinary rule. We believe the record shows the following basic scenario occurred in this case. First, Ms. Meyer, in a telephone conference, spoke with Mr. Duschenman about the possibility of retaining him to commence a divorce action on her behalf. In that telephone conversation, Mr. Duschenman and the prospective client discussed matters of marital finances. I don't think there's anything unusual about that type of conversation between a divorce lawyer and a potential client. Third, one of the things that was discussed in that conversation was a series of financial transactions which appeared to be loans between Ms. Meyer's mother extended to the husband as part of a family trucking business. Fourth, in that conversation, Ms. Meyer did not retain Mr. Duschenman, and Mr. Duschenman has admitted that he was aware that he had not been retained in the case. Next, at the close of that conversation, I believe that same day, Mr. Duschenman sent an information packet out to the prospective client, asked that she fill information out and return it. I believe at that point, Ms. Meyer had a right to expect that what she had said to Mr. Duschenman in that telephone conversation would remain private until a decision was made to go forward with the representation.
But it was the mother, wasn't it, that contacted Attorney Duschenman initially and said she was doing so on behalf of her daughter and wanted her to talk to her daughter?
I don't believe that's an absolutely accurate recitation of what's in the record, Your Honor. There was a dispute. The mother did not recall a conversation with Mr. Duschenman. Mr. Duschenman recalled a conversation with the mother about possibly referring the daughter to her. The daughter and the mother spoke about the daughter contacting Mr. Duschenman, and then she went ahead and made the phone call.
But I have not read the findings of fact in the last few days, but wasn't there a finding that, in fact, Mom did contact, or essentially approach Mr. Duschenman in this restaurant where Mr. Duschenman was having a cup of coffee?
That was Mr. Duschenman's testimony, was that there were two conversations on the day of the events in question, one of them in the morning in which the mother discussed with him referring.
But what about Appendix 105, Finding of Fact 3?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that refers to the conversation in the morning that was testified to by Mr. Duschenman that the mother didn't recall, and since that's the referee's finding of fact, I believe that's taken as fact. That
then isn't it a very reasonable inference that, in fact, Mom and daughter were acting together on this? There's no breach of client confidentiality whatsoever.
I think that's a bit of a leap, Your Honor. I mean, most lawyers get business by virtue of referrals from other people who they know. And I don't think that the fact that there's a referral given or that the referral source tells the lawyer, I'm going to suggest that so-and-so call you, somehow makes the two people joint clients or suggests that the prospective client is okay with the lawyer going back and talking to a referral source, whether it's a family member or someone else. I mean, referrals of that type would frequently happen. For example, my firm does a lot of business work. We represent corporations that have corporate boards. If one member of the board recommends a lawyer to another board member, does that mean the lawyer can discuss one client's business with the other? I think that's a bit of a leap.
Can let me follow that through with some of these other findings of fact. So, but the referee found that the only thing that could have been divulged of a confidential nature was a question with respect to a loan. That's finding of fact number 10.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's not disputed by LRS, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that Mr. Duchemin did not disclose any information which he obtained during their phone conversation. Other than that, that's finding of fact 11.
That finding of fact 11, I think, is crucial to the issues in this case, Your Honor.
So you do dispute that?
We dispute finding of fact 11 because it's our position, as we've articulated in our brief, that finding of fact 11 is essentially a conclusion of law.
I see. That's right.
Okay.
Let me make sure that I understand. You're indicating that you disagree with finding of fact number 11. It's a conclusion of law. I thought also your argument was that under 20.16a, that a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client, and that your position wasn't that he disclosed necessarily confidential information from the conversation with the daughter, but rather you are taking issue with him having advised the mother that he was representing the daughter. Am I correct or incorrect?
I think it's twofold. To make that slightly more specific, Your Honor, there's two issues of, quote, unquote, information relating to the representation, which is the key language of the rule, which we feel there was a breach of here. Number one, the statement to the mother that I spoke with your daughter about a potential divorce action this morning, number one, and number two, the discussion that then ensued concerning these intra-family loans, which Mr. Duchemin in his testimony characterized as asking the mother a series of questions about these transactions in order to get more detail about them.
Let me advance this argument and have you respond to it. You are taking exception and attempting to impose discipline because the respondent here spoke with the mother, telling the mother that he spoke with the daughter. Nothing more. That's one of the basis for which you are wanting to impose discipline here.
Spoke with the daughter about a potential divorce action.
Spoke with the daughter about the potential divorce action. Okay, spoke with the daughter about the potential divorce action.
And our position is that that's information relating to the representation.
Okay. Why isn't that, under these circumstances, something that is impliedly authorized? These circumstances, unlike your hypothetical about some referral, you know, let me just fill it in, some accountant referring a client to a business attorney to do some kind of a buy-sell agreement. That's not what we're talking about here. That isn't necessarily doesn't necessarily authorize the third party. But here you have, as I understand it, the mother's a waitress in the restaurant that's close by, maybe next door to the office. That the respondent, according to the facts, is goes there with some frequency. The mother's the waitress, and they are at least referred to as friends. Who knows? Anyway, they see each other on occasion. And then the mother says to the respondent, hey, my daughter's going through a divorce, and I told her to call you. Lo and behold, when the respondent returns to his office, there's a message from the daughter. He calls, talks with the daughter, and then later in the day is back at this restaurant close by and says to the mother, I talked to your daughter about the divorce, period. Do you disagree with any of the facts that I've put forth?
No, Your Honor. I think that's a fair characterization of the record, because Mr. Duschenman does indicate that he initiated that conversation in the afternoon and that he did mention that it involved a call from the daughter about a divorce action.
Of course, there's no finding of fact with regard to impliedly. But boy, in that situation where the mother says, it's my daughter, divorce, told her to talk with you, just the fact that he comes back and says, I talked with your daughter, period. You're imposing about the divorce. You know, what else could it have been in that context? That is the basis for imposition of discipline. And it seems to me I have problems with that. So tell me why I shouldn't have problems with that. Tell me why that is serious conduct sufficient for a private reprimand.
I think in this context, Your Honor, it's serious only because it was coupled with the subsequent questioning of the mother concerning the loan transaction.
On that issue, though, didn't the daughter specifically say during the phone conversation with the attorney that one of her goals was to see to it, in the context of this potential divorce, that her mother's interests with respect to those loans would be protected?
I think that the testimony in the record, Your Honor, was that there was some discussion that the daughter was concerned about her mother's financial interests. That is correct.
And that she wanted them protected. Isn't that what the testimony was, that she wanted to make sure that her mother's interests were protected, or words to that effect?
There probably were words somewhat to that effect, Your Honor. I don't have the...
So under those circumstances, why, consistent with what Justice Bradley has outlined, was this contact not impliedly authorized, if that was specifically one of those sub-goals, if you will, of the representation?
Because the representation at that point was not confirmed.
Is that the guts of this case, then, that the representation was not at that point firmed up?
I think that it is, Your Honor, and let me elaborate on that point a little bit. The guts of the rule in this case refers to revealing information relating to the representation. The way that this rule is drafted and what the sources in our briefs say about this rule is that it was very controversial because it's very broad. And I would liken it to the old Venn diagrams that we all had in high school mathematics. The concept of information relating to the representation is like the blackboard, a black hole. Nothing comes out of there without an express exception under the rule, either express authorization from the client, implied authorization from the client, or some of the exceptions such as the crime fraud exception, which have no bearing here. So in this case, we're left with the conversation occurs between the lawyer and the prospective client, the telephone call. The client, we believe, under the rule, rightly has the right to assume that what's said in that conversation remains private. It's in the black hole of the lawyer's office. What's revealed by the client in that conversation doesn't get out absent express or implied authorization. Mr. Duschenman has conceded that he had no express authorization, and the issue as framed to the referee by the pleadings in this case, as presented in the testimony and as argued, focused on the issue of implied authorization. So the answer to the question, is that the guts of the case? I think the answer is yes, until the lawyer knows that he's authorized to proceed on behalf of that client, there cannot be implied authorization to be discussing, revealing information related to that representation, because there's nothing that the lawyer should be doing at that point. Until the client says, yes, we're going to proceed with this, yes, start looking into it, at that point, I would concede, yes, Mr. Duschenman has talked to the client, what are the issues of property division here, and consistent with that, on some occasions, is he going to talk to the client before he talks to a third party? Probably. On other occasions, is he going to assume, yes, I've got to go ahead to talk to it, I've got to get my job done? Yes, I think the mother in that situation would fall into that category if this representation had been firmed up.
So, if I understand your argument, had the client and the attorney in this case reached an understanding that he would represent her and will make it really official, signed in a retainer agreement, and then, without discussing it with the client, the attorney investigated the case by going to the mother and saying just what is the status of these financial agreements or arrangements, loan, gift, et cetera, and may have gone to the bank, checked on deposits, et cetera. Would that be a violation of any code if he did all this and didn't check with her exactly as to how he was proceeding?
I think under that scenario, Your Honor, we'd have a very difficult time saying that that's a violation of the rule because, as the commentators also say, the concept of implied authorization is very amorphous. And I think in that situation, one has to defer to a lawyer's reasonable judgment call about when do I need to tell my client what I'm going to be doing to investigate their case, and when do I need to just proceed using my own judgment.
Well, the result then is if you're not a client and you make a revelation, you're more protected than if you are a client and make a revelation.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor, because the rules make it clear that the duties of the lawyer do apply to prospective clients and communications between lawyers and persons who are not clients who have approached the lawyer for purposes of seeking possible legal representation. I think that principle is clear from cases where the confidentiality of lawyer-client communications under the privilege rule 90503 has been before the court.
The point is, though, that it's a higher duty, I think, is the thrust of the chief's. I think the thrust of it here is that it's a higher duty prior to retention than it is after retention. And is there any support in the rule for that construction?
I don't think there's any support in the express language of the rule for that, but I think as a matter of common sense, if I'm correct about the rule being a blackboard or a black hole, until you've got the relationship established, the black hole really ought to never be having anything leaking out of that.
So the lawyer is not entitled to rely on any implied implied authorization before, but he is after.
Yes, I think that's perfectly reasonable under the rule, Your Honor.
So if I were a lawyer called by a business or landowners on zoning and asked to represent them, and we start talking about the representation, and they're not sure they want to hire me, and frankly, I'm not so sure I want to represent them. And so if I go through, if I want to find out more about them or more about the business or zoning issue, I would have to say to the client, look, I'm not sure I want to represent you, but I'm going to do a little investigation into this matter to determine whether I'm interested. And you can investigate me and talk around about me to see if you're interested in me. Is that the way that we should proceed?
I think that's reasonable, Your Honor. I think that if the lawyer is going to be talking about the client's business outside the office, that should be discussed with the client before the lawyer proceeds to do that. Otherwise, what's happening is that you're going to have information leaking out into the public that doesn't belong out there, and that the client, I think, reasonably wouldn't expect to have publicly disseminated. I mean, there's all kinds of hypotheticals we can dream up. For example, let's assume you've got somebody who's been charged with a criminal offense. They go and interview a lawyer. They talk about the facts. The potential defendant reveals a potential alibi defense, doesn't hire the lawyer yet. Things are left up in the air as they were here. Is the criminal defense lawyer supposed to be interviewing the alibi witness at that point?
Let's take this hypothetical. My next-door neighbor is charged with that offense and says to me, hey, Justice Bradley, as my next-door neighbor calls me, says, hey, Ann, my kid is charged with this offense. Who should I go see? And I said, I'll say, I can't tell you. Talk to my husband, who's a lawyer. So my husband is a lawyer. He says, go see John Smith. So lo and behold, apparently, they go see John Smith, and John Smith sees my husband, Mark, on the street a couple days later and says, hey, the Burks came in. Thanks for sending them to me. You would then see that as a violation of the attorney responding to my husband Mark's referral and find that as a basis for discipline?
I think under a strict reading of the rule, perhaps that alone is information relating to the representation. Is it a prosecutable violation without going further and saying, discussing some aspect of the potential case? I doubt it.
Well,
I mean, they called me.
You nuance this and say prosecutable, but at the very beginning, the very first question I asked you was to make sure I understood that you were going forward with regard to two avenues of violation. One was that he telling the mother that he spoke with the daughter about the divorce, period. That was the first. And then the second dealt with the loan. And I think my hypothetical is tantamount to that first violation that you're proceeding on. Now, you might not want to prosecute it, but that's a different issue. The question is whether or not this is a violation.
The first part, I would concede that Your Honor's hypothetical does cover the first part. It's the second part, really, that is of concern here, given the relationship between the mother and the daughter. And I think the relationship between the mother and the daughter is central to the theory of implied consent or implied authorization that has been advanced in defense of this case.
How do you want the court to handle this case, counsel?
We have expressly asked in our brief that this case be treated as a private reprimand case. I think under the new rules there is a provision for unpublished private reprimands, and if the court was to find a violation that ought to be treated as a private reprimand, probably the appropriate way to do that would be through an unpublished opinion combined with a brief publication in the Wisconsin Bar Journal that would outline the parameters of the case without giving names, so that future practitioners would be more fully apprised of exactly the nature of the duty under 20:1.6 in the event that they're dealing with a situation like this where discussions go on before there has been a formal retainer.
Mr. Attorney Duschman, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that name.
It is Duschman.
Duschman. How long has he been in practice?
Since 1970, Your Honor.
32 years. Any complaints?
None, Your Honor.
No violations whatsoever?
That is correct.
So why is LRS going after him on this? What is so important about this to LRS? What are the principles you're trying to establish?
I think the principle in substance, Your Honor, is to get an articulation of what is the lawyer's duty under 20:1.6a, particularly in connection with the a situation such as we have here where there is this type of discussion of quote-unquote information relating to the client without express authorization, and we would submit without implied authorization, absent the firming up of that attorney-client relationship.
Isn't there something short of a private reprimand that you can do?
Unfortunately, it appears under the code, the way it's drafted now, there is not, absent the assent of the respondent. And in fact, the investigator explored all of those options and made very clear to me that he would have liked to have had such options available to him, but regrettably they were not.
There used to be a letter of, I forgot what it was called, maybe admonition or warning or caution, maybe a letter of caution.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. There was a letter of caution option.
That's still possible.
It is not in this scenario.
In any scenario?
I believe it's possible when it's an OLR matter, but under this scenario, under the code as it's drafted now, it is not.
Oh, because it's the special. It comes under the special.
That's what Mr. Smith understood when he came to my office and referred this this matter to me. I traced through 2208 specifically at the outset here to make clear to the court that those were the options available.
So people who volunteer to work in the system and are therefore, when complaints are made, funneled into the special investigator part of the system are held to a higher standard?
I think the problem is that there may be less flexibility with the panel if there is a difference. But the way in which this works is there's a finding of cause to proceed under 2225 sub 7 that refers the special investigator back to the options available under 2208 sub 2, which apply when there is a finding of cause to proceed. There's basically two options open. You file a complaint or you attempt to work something out by way of an agreement with the respondent.
Right, but it functionally holds those people to a higher standard because the options that exist when OLR is handling these matters of issuing caution letters or counseling and closing files, et cetera, it does not exist or do not exist?
Well, I know that there is a diversion option under 22 sub 10, but that requires consent.
Okay, what is there a letter of caution under either procedure?
I'm not sure that there is anymore, Your Honor. Okay. There used to be.
All right.
But I know the investigator was adamant with me about the fact that he felt this was the only option open to him.
Okay. Thank you. The only option. Thank you, Mr. Schwarzenbart. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Hart, representing Mr. Dutcheman.
My name is Webster Hart. I represent James R. Dutcheman, who is the respondent in this matter. I am also his partner and have been for over 30 years in the practice of law in Eau Claire. I'd like to say at the outset that Mr. Dutcheman did not consent to any type of an alternate disposition because he felt he had done nothing wrong. In order to determine whether there has been a violation of the rule prohibiting revealing information relating to the representation of a client, it is necessary to analyze, one, what was revealed, and two, whether there was implied authority to reveal it being the revelation. We can't look at these issues in a global sense, but we must look at them on a revelation-by-revelation basis because the implied authority will differ depending upon what the revelation is. The comment to the rule states...
Mr. Hart, before you go further, does your client still take the position that he wouldn't consent to any option even now?
Yes.
Of course, if at least under the old procedures, I recall, the person that was a person in Mr. Dutcheman's position would not have the opportunity to consent. The board could simply send him a letter of warning. And
that's correct.
He could not open it up, but it would still be there.
Right.
But that's not available at all.
I'm not aware of whether it is or is not.
Would it be available if he wasn't a member of the special committee?
It's my understanding that being a committee member does take it out of the normal procedure, but I did not analyze this on a procedural basis.
It takes it out of the normal procedures for getting here, but I don't know, and I didn't look this up, as to whether it takes it out of the normal opportunities for diversion, cautions, warnings, et cetera. So, and you're not here to discuss
that. I'm not here to challenge that. I have some feelings about the overzealousness of the investigation and the investigator. Anyone who compared the statement of Jennifer Meyer with her testimony under oath before Judge Fiorenza would note a significant difference. And the court is also aware, I believe, by virtue of the record, that the irritation source of this whole problem was because she got a bill for the telephone conference, which was a matter of the automatic billing process of the office. That bill was subsequently canceled when it was determined that it had been sent, because without a retainer agreement following it up. But that's got nothing to do with this.
Fill in those bones. Put a little more meat on those bones for me, counsel. What do you see as the big discrepancy between what she said when this was being tried and what her complaint was?
The conversation that Jennifer Mayer had with the investigator was based upon a conversation that Jennifer Mayer had with her mother. So she was not relating to the investigator what Mr. Duschman had said, but she was relating what her mother had said. For example, the issue of whether or not Mr. Duschman had made a derogatory remark about Randy Meyer, the husband of Jennifer, the Judge Fiorenza found that he had not. But and in fact, in the testimony, Jill Johnson, the mother, indicated that she was undoubtedly the one that had made the derogatory remark about the husband, and not Mr. Duschman. But in Mr. Smith's report and the statement that he obtained through Jennifer Meyer, it came out that Mr. Duschman was making derogatory remarks. But if we look at the record under oath, subject to cross-examination, it is clear that that was not the case. And that's why it's important to be looking at these findings as they relate to whether or not there can be implied authority. The problem we get into with what Mr. Schwarzenbart was suggesting is that this rule, if taken literally, as Justice Bradley has suggested, whenever a referral comes in, and you then see that person who made the referral in the courthouse or some other public place and say, thanks for making the referral, you have violated this rule. I do not believe that that is correct. I do not believe that the rule is violated. And the reason it's not violated is that there must be implied authority by the person who is accepting the recommendation of another individual and then communicates that to the lawyer, saying, my mother told me you were a good lawyer and could handle this case for me, because that's what happened here. My mother said that you would talk to me about my divorce action, and the reason for that, and that's in the record, Jill Johnson had asked Mr. Duschman if he would take the case. Mr. Duschman is a busy lawyer. He doesn't accept every case. But instead of having one of the other lawyers in the office handle it, the mother wanted Duschman individually. So she says, will you take the case? Will you accept a call from my daughter? She tells her daughter, get Mr. Duschman. The daughter, when she calls up, says, my mother told me to get you as my lawyer. I mean, this is the basis for implied authority. It's stronger than a situation. Prior to lawyer advertising, that's all. The only way we got business was referral from other people. And it was common practice, and is common practice, to thank the person, either personally, by phone, or by a letter. And we just say, thanks for the referral of Joe Blow. You don't say anything about the case other than the fact that you have been contacted by that person. And that completes the circle, and that's what happened here. Revelation number one, your daughter called. Okay, that's the end of that. What is the second revelation?
One of the problems is that I think our code still has a provision that says the name of your client is confidential. So maybe when I say new, it's relatively new. In the old days, that means when I practiced law, it did not, which I'm the same era as you all are, clients' names were not public, were not confidential. The fact that somebody came to consult you was open. What they said was not. So one of these business about thanking for referral, I'm not so sure, and that's not charged, and we're not going into that, but I'm not sure that that's okay anymore.
I thought about that.
I
thought about that. And how the way I came down on its being okay or not is the nature of the solicitation of that particular lawyer to begin with. If, you know, it would be wrong for me to say to my wife or somebody in a public place, I was contacted by Joe Blow to do some legal work. That would be wrong. But because of the referral aspect, because of selecting this lawyer, I want this lawyer, call this lawyer, get this lawyer to do it. And then he knew it. I mean, that's the key. He knew that she was calling him because her mother had recommended him. So that's where the implied authority for that comes in. Okay, what's revelation number two? Revelation number two is nothing other than a question. How much money did you loan them? Now, he didn't reveal anything. He didn't disclose anything that he had learned from Jennifer Mayer. What he did do is reveal that there was a conversation with Jennifer Mayer about money, but he isn't telling Jill Johnson what that conversation was. Did he have implied authority to do that? Yes. How did he have that authority? Jennifer Mayer was concerned about protecting her mother's interest and told Mr. Duschman that. Jill Johnson had loaned money. It was important to Jennifer that money be money that came back to her mother and was not a deduction from any division of property that came as a result of the divorce. The efforts of Mr. Duschman to find out about the loans, he said, okay, how much money did you loan, and get the documentation together to demonstrate that. Why is that wrong? Mr. Schwarzenbart says it's wrong because Duschman didn't know yet that he had been retained. But Duschman did know, and it's in the record, that Jennifer Mayer, the daughter, had told him that Randy Mayer, the husband, had already gone to another law office across the river. And there was concern that this thing was going to get rolling, and Duschman would not be prepared for the temporary hearing.
Counsel?
Yes.
I'm looking at SCR 20.1.6, confidentiality.
Yes.
And generally as a preface, I think that it states, a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to representation of a client unless the client consents. Okay. Now, I think that is viewed as both the fact of representation, relating to a representation, as well as what is said within communications. We've discussed a bit the fact of representation. It's your position that there's been an implied authority to give to the mother the fact of that representation, in part because of the referral. I mean, there are some contexts where the mere fact that you are representing someone still remains common.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Then I look at the comment to the rules, and it says authorized disclosure. A lawyer is impliedly authorized to make disclosure about a client when appropriate in carrying out the representation, except to the extent that the client's instructions or special circumstances limit that authority. So the way the comments are worded, it seems like that there has to be a carrying out of the representation before you can find implied authorization. If you would literally look at those comments. Do you have any response to that?
I do.
That goes to the argument of whether he's retained or not retained.
Right. That goes to the retained, not retained. I'm a little bit confused by the Office of Lawyer Regulation position on this. We conceded that we would treat this as if there was representation on the assumption that it was a higher burden on the part of the lawyer, not that it was a lower burden. I may find that I'm wrong about that, but that was, we made that concession. Let's not argue about whether there was representation or not here. Let's talk as if there is and go forward. And so we've treated it that way. But the issue of whether, of the comment saying whether it's appropriate for the representation, I don't agree that you have to have that signed retainer agreement to be representing somebody. Sometimes that comes later. It comes it's not as clear-cut as we would like to think it is. We all strive to either have letters of retainer or signed retainer agreements, as is indicated by the rules, but sometimes that doesn't come in the sequence where we say we're not doing anything until that occurs. And that's particularly true if there's a situation where there's a feeling that there's some urgency, as I was referring to. The law office across the river is representing the husband. We got to get going on this thing. Get these documents together. And that's basically what he said to Jill Johnson. He didn't say anything about what Jennifer had said. He didn't tell her, the mother, anything about the conversation. He may not have even been revealing information relating to the action, because a revelation requires something that somebody doesn't know. He may have been aware of the fact that Jill Johnson had loaned money to this family from his earlier conversations with Mrs. Johnson, and said, get together the documents and tell me how much you loaned. Because in his mind, he knows that the daughter wants the mom protected. So he's a diligent lawyer. Are we going to start disciplining lawyers because they get, you know, most of the cases that you read, and incidentally, I got a copy of the compendium that just came out not too long ago by this court on lawyer regulation or lawyer discipline cases. There were 7 confidentiality cases that were public reprimands, either suspensions or public, and 4 that were privates. Of the 7 publics, 4 of them involved a situation where the lawyer used information for his own personal gain. He used information he got from the client for his own benefit. And 3 of them were when he handed the file off to some other lawyer because he didn't want it anymore without the client's consent. Nothing like what we're talking about here. And the 4 private reprimands were 2 and 2. 2 where the lawyer used the information for his own gain. 2 where he passed off the file for somebody else to see. What we have here are 2 revelations. 1, thanks for your referral. 2, get together any documents you've got about financing. I mean, I don't think that the rule, it may not be as clear as it could be, but I don't think the rule prohibits those, and the reason is implied authority. There simply has to be implied authority for those revelations.
Well, now, is it your position that Attorney Duchovny was representing the daughter?
Yes, in his mind he was.
And I gather that you think reveal means you have to reveal something the party doesn't know, that the mother didn't know. So what the mother knew was daughter was going to call. Mother knew daughter was interested in a divorce. And mother knew that she had given, lent, whatever, money to the daughter and the husband for the business.
That is my position, but I don't think
that's
determinative. I don't think that's determinative. You know, I that's the way I came down on this initially when I was looking at it. But then the more I thought about it and looking at the rule, it's got to be based on implied authority. And that's why you have to look at what the revelation is.
It's got to be based on what?
Implied authority.
Implied authority, okay.
And you got to look at the revelation. What's being revealed? Because if he had said to the mother something about the conduct of Randy, you know, he's... Jennifer told me he's run around with other people or he's been beating her or anything like that, that would not have been authorized under an implied authority thing. But I think you have to look at, in order to make any sense out of it, you have to look at this from an implied authority standpoint. And in order to look at it from implied authority, you have to look at all the facts. And the facts for the second revelation were Jennifer had told Attorney Duschamp about the loans. Jennifer knew that her mother was concerned about the money. Jennifer wanted it clear that the money that Jill had loaned had gone to Randy for his truck and not for family expense. Jennifer did not tell Duschamp not to discuss the loans with her mother. She wanted him to protect her mom. Okay. You look at those facts. Those are the facts. Those are what Judge Fiorenza found. What's in the record?
Let me ask this. Confidentiality rule applies to conversations between lawyers and prospective clients pre-retention,
yes.
Correct? Okay. So assuming that's the status of this conversation, what the system is arguing here is for a rule of law or an interpretation of this rule that says that there can never be, in that context, an implied authorization. That's how I read what's being requested here,
yeah,
by your opponent, that the system wants us to interpret this rule to say that conversations between attorneys and prospective clients, pre-retention, formal retention conversations, are confidential under this rule, and everybody concedes that this rule covers those conversations, but that in that situation there can never be an implied authorization to disclose. Is that how you read their
argument? That's how I read it, too.
Okay. And tell us what's wrong with that rule.
Well, the rule doesn't make any sense, because why would you want to foreclose even an acknowledgement of a referral until the representation had been made? It simply sets up a trap for lawyers to get caught in by saying you've got to have that, and when is the retainer complete? I mean, when is it that somebody is now officially retained so he can have implied authority? Can't people impliedly or expressly authorize prior to retention? They certainly can expressly authorize. It's okay to talk to my mom about this. Why would there be a prohibition against implied authority? It just doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Hart, what do you want to come out of this case? What do you want this court to do?
I want the court to dismiss the claim or the complaint against Mr. Duschamp.
Well, but how?
Well,
there's some fairly heavy legal issues here in interpretation of an important rule. Do you want us to discuss this at length and publish it, or do you want us not to discuss it, or what do you want?
Well, I was not a fan of having, you know, it's kind of incongruous to have a private reprimand and then have a big publication about it, but I think Judge Fiorenza was right. I mean, the Office of Lawyer Regulation hooks its whole case on the fact that it claims that finding 11 is a misstatement in it, or is misidentified as a finding of fact, that the respondent did not disclose any information which he obtained from Mrs. Meyer during their phone conversation. Why is that not a legitimate finding of fact? What the Office of Lawyer Regulation is really saying is that Judge Fiorenza did not make a conclusion that there was implied authority. But he made a conclusion that the respondent didn't violate Supreme Court Rule 21.6. Doesn't that carry with it the fact that, the rule says you can't make a revelation unless you've got implied authority to do so. That's exactly what he found. I think that this court has to just say Judge Fiorenza's decision stands. the complaint be dismissed and no cost. I'm not so sure I like that, but so be it.
How can you go ahead?
What if it's found to be a technical violation, that is, not the first fact of representation, but discussion or some reference to the loan? Your opposing counsel says, hey, look, the investigator tried to resolve this. The rules, and I'll have to look at them more closely, but the rules as we adopted them have this whole diversion of program for when they OLR really doesn't want to go forward, even though there may be a violation or a technical violation, and they can say, okay, you have to, in a trust account thing, do something about trust account, but we're not going to find any violation. And when there's a question about whether or not you know enough about the ethics rule, you have to take an ethics class. And that's part of the whole diversionary program that the bar, I think, you know, embraced. They like this because that gave room then in something that might be considered a very minor violation or technical violation to address it. But then, I'm playing devil's advocate, when the respondent says no, then OLR is left to say, okay, what's my other option? Is that how this case unfolds? Maybe that's not a fair question, but I ask.
Well, I know what you're saying. I hesitate to say this, and you know, I wasn't present when Mr. Smith came around and made his statements to Mr. Dushman. Mr. Dushman obviously was there. But, you know, we don't want the cops telling us what the law is. We want the judiciary telling us what the law is. What's the rule here? How are the now 15,000 of us, I guess, going to conduct ourselves over the next decade, two, three, four? Are we going to now understand that we cannot say anything to anybody about thanks for the call or thanks for the referral until after that retainer agreement is signed and after the representation is clear? You know, I guess that's what I meant by saying it's an additional hoop. I don't think so. I mean, we still, and you know, the state is not the same every place. You know, it's a little different in Milwaukee and Madison and Green Bay and Wausau and Eau Claire and Superior and La Crosse. Different, you know, different rules apply. And that's why I think you have to go to the situation of saying, you know, we looked at this thing. Judge Fiorenza is right. He didn't say there's applied authority, but, you know, he didn't have to say it. Case dismissed. And I don't think that's wrong. I don't think it's wrong for lawyers to say to another lawyer in the courthouse, thanks for the referral. Or I don't think it's wrong for a lawyer to hit the ground running when he honestly believes that he or she has been retained.
The problem is sometimes it's wrong.
But sure.
And thanks for the referral sometimes can be exceedingly damaging. You know, I'm representing one defendant in a civil action, so I can't represent the other one, and so I say, go to the guy down the street, I want to know if he's going to go to the guy down the street, because I'm going to file a cross-claim against this person, if, you know, blah, blah. That hypothetical might not work. But my point is that innocent thanks for the referral can just raise light bulbs with all sorts of consequential damage. And so we cannot write an opinion that says thanks for the referral is benign.
No, but under the facts of this case, when the mom says, call the guy, and says to the guy, will you take the case, and says, you know, then I think you can. And I think you can write that rule. You can say, in this case, there was implied authority.
Counsel?
Yeah.
Are you done answering, Justice Bradley?
Well, I just had a little hook. Can I make the hook on it?
Sure.
You brought up the issue of conflicts. What happens when somebody calls you up and says, I want to sue XYZ Corporation? I can't. I represent them. Oops. What? You just say, I can't. I've got a conflict of interest. You just say, I can't. Then the person calling you up says, well, you know, who's this lawyer? Doesn't he want the clients anymore? I mean, that's tough. But I think you can follow Judge Fiorenza, dismiss the complaint, and, yeah, no cost.
Counsel, in terms of the process, does this go through the primary body? In order for LRS to proceed, who reviews the decision to proceed with the complaint? And did you have an opportunity to address anybody other than the investigator?
No. Although I wasn't, quote, retained at that level.
What was your bill on this case?
So I don't know if I would have been or not.
I can't speak for anybody. I obviously have some questions about the judgment bringing this thing forward. Whose judgment was involved in all of this that got us to the point where seven or six justices are spending an hour and a lot of other time reviewing a complaint the likes of which I haven't seen in 20 years?
Well, I can only assume it's Mr. Schwarzenberg.
Well, doesn't the SCR tell us, SCR 22.25, first you get a complaint asserted somewhere in the system and misconduct, and then you get an investigator, just like you do if the attorney had not been on any board or committee. And then after the investigation, if there's a decision by the investigator that the information is sufficient to support an allegation of possible misconduct, then the investigator can dismiss the matter or prepare a report, sends the copy of the report to the respondent and to the grievant, and they each can write a response. I'm on 22.25.4. The special investigator can submit the report, and if after these responses it goes to a special preliminary review panel to determine whether there's cause for the special investigator to proceed. And that's exactly the process that's used without the special investigator. And so you need a vote, an affirmative vote of four or more members of the panel that there should be a proceeding. And then still the special investigator has various provisions. And if there's still continuation, then the same potential discipline, which is 22.082, that the preliminary review panel has, the special review panel has, and there are only three. Obtain the respondent's consent to a public or private reprimand. Divert the matter under 22.10. And I think when I read 22.10, it means you really found that it's more significant than a public or private reprimand. Or C, file with the court and prosecute a complaint. Those are the ways of proceeding.
We were not invited to the panel proceedings.
No, that's done on a paper record. But your response was given to the special review panel,
yes.
And the grievance statements were given to them, and then the panel makes a decision.
And then, as we found here, there was a significant difference between the grievance statement and
right.
the grievance testimony.
Which, as you know, depositions sometimes are different than trial testimony, which raises a real question of credibility.
Or what the officer's report says.
Thank you, Chief.
You're welcome.
For answering my question that I put to this attorney.
Were you satisfied with my response?
Yes, I thought it was very
thank
good.
You. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hart, if there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Schwarzenberg, did I say what happened, roughly?
I believe Your Honor has traced the rules quite accurately and succinctly. And the process did, in fact, operate that way. There was an investigation by Mr. Smith. Was reviewed by his panel. There was a finding of cause to proceed. I don't remember what the vote was. I think it may have been unanimous.
Well, it had to be four or more, at least under that.
I do want to touch
on. And then you were hired by?
By Mr. Smith.
Okay. So that's where you came in after this was done.
I came in after this was done. The investigation was complete. The vote had been taken. Mr. Smith brought in his file to me and said he'd like to retain me because I've been doing this kind of work in one capacity or another since 1984. I want to address, as a matter of common sense, Justice Babich's comment that this is the case the likes of which he hasn't seen in 20 years. Well, my first prosecution case for the former BAPR was 18 years ago, and I agree with the observation, Your Honor, and I think that if Mr. Smith was here today, he'd probably be telling you he would have liked to have done a letter of caution on this case, but that option wasn't available to him. I want to make one other common sense observation based on my years of experience in prosecuting these cases on occasion over really since 1984 when I first got involved assisting another lawyer. Most disciplinary grievances arise because a lawyer made a mistake. And the mistake can be many things. It can range from I never should have taken that engagement and I got a crazy client to a mistake that's a disciplinary violation. Mr. Duschenman doesn't want to admit he made a mistake in this proceeding, but I would submit that he did and that there was a violation. Is it a technical violation that we should overlook, or is it a technical violation that should be the subject of some form of discipline as mild as it could possibly be? The mistake I believe Mr. Duschenman made, which I think is reflected in counsel's argument here today, is really a lack of respect for the autonomy of the client who was the daughter. The prospective client was the daughter, it was not the mother. And Mr. Duschenman didn't respect the autonomy of the daughter who was, if there was going to be a client, she was the client.
Aren't the facts a little more ambiguous than that? We have here a referral from a mother in a divorce action. The mother has known the attorney for a long time, and she makes the referral, says that she's going to get a call, or he's going to get a call from her daughter about this divorce action. The call comes in, the call is returned. In the context of that call, there are representations made by the daughter that in addition to potentially prosecuting this divorce action on her behalf, she wants her mother's interests in this loan or financial transaction or transactions with the husband, her mother's interests also protected. I think that's a little more ambiguous than you're representing to us.
Well, I think that still, Your Honor, the duty that was owed to the daughter who was on the phone. And I think the mistake that the attorney made was to leap to the conclusion that these two people I can treat as one, even though if you look at what was said about this loan transaction, you've basically got a potentially adversarial situation here in the sense that this loan, as a matter of domestic relations law, may well have been a marital obligation. And that, in fact, there's another rule that's operative by implication here, which is contacting an unrepresented person. And that Ms. Johnson, in her position potentially as a creditor of her daughter, was an unrepresented person. I think that, you know, having heard that, I believe Mr. Ducheman needed to proceed with more caution and to be more careful and to realize, yes, there's a potential, there are differences between the mother and daughter, and in fact there's a potential conflict here because whether the daughter likes it or not, if the loan is made in the interest of the marriage and the family, that may be a marital asset and a marital obligation. And, you know, before I start going down that road and talking to the now unrepresented person, the mother, I need to review this with my client and to proceed with some care and caution before simply going out and talking to the client's mother.
Assuming we accept that construction of the facts here, was my characterization of the legal interpretation of the rule that you are seeking correct, that you want us to interpret this confidentiality rule, which does apply to conversations between attorney and prospective client pre-formal retention. You want us to interpret that to exclude any implied authorization.
I always hesitate to agree with statements that are made that absolutely and that literally, but I would agree that's what our position in this case does amount to, Your Honor.
And isn't that a dangerous interpretation as far as the real world is concerned?
Any absolutist interpretation always has some potential with it, but I would submit, Your Honor, in this case, whether we go to the absolute or the not quite absolute, that in this case, Mr. Ducheman, when he went beyond saying, my daughter called you, and proceeded to get into a discussion about that loan, which was not an emergency situation by any means whatsoever, that he crossed that line.
Well, what about the attorney with a prospective client does not have the implied authorization to investigate details about the matters?
If I understand what Your Honor is saying, I think I'm in agreement with that position, because I think any time the attorney undertakes an investigation by talking to third parties, the very questions that are posed by the attorney necessarily by implication reveal the contents of the communications with the client, because where is the attorney getting the information that he's coming to the third party with in order to ask those questions? Of course he's getting it from the client, so by necessary implication, that is a revelation.
Can I clarify the
Justice Press?
At the point that the referee makes a decision that the rule has not been violated, who is it who makes the decision to bring it to this court? Who made it?
That decision was made by Mr. Smith.
Not the panel?
No, I don't believe he reviewed that with the panel at the time the decision was made. I think what Mr. Smith understood is when he gets cause to proceed from the panel, that then the ball is in his court and it's his call to proceed under 2208 sub 2.
Similar to what the OLR director would have if it was not a special investigation.
Yeah, correct. The OLR director would not have to go back to the panels to get new cause to proceed with respect to an
OLR appeal. Director would just proceed as he saw fit under these rules, and the special investigator sits in his chair, in effect.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the special investigator a lawyer?
Yes, he is.
Does he have to be?
I don't believe so. I believe there are non-lawyer members of those panels. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor.
As there are on OLR.
Yes,
thank
there
you.
Are.
Thank you, Mr. Schwarzenberg. Thank you, Mr. Hart, both of you, for an excellent oral argument this morning. The court is in recess until 1:45 for our third case of the month. Of this. Thank you.